By now, a lot of you have heard the recording. It was a nearly three-hour conversation between a woman not identified and Joseph Bishop, a man who had served in various high-ranking positions in the LDS Church. He was president of the church's missionary training center in Provo in the 1980s. Last week, the recording was released by the website Mormon Leaks. And about 40 minutes into the interview, the woman, who at first said she was a reporter gathering information for a story, revealed the real reason she was talking to Bishop. She said that he had raped her in a room in the training center basement in 1984. She was a missionary at the time. The recording is gut-wrenching. In it, she says she wanted to confront Bishop and extract from him an apology and a confession. She was also hoping to get some measure of closure to an incident that had completely changed her life.
What you did to me destroyed my faith and testimony in priesthood leaders and in the church.
Wow.
You took me down. You don't remember taking a sister missionary downstairs into the basement? Okay, let me say this. I need honest time and... You know, it's a long time ago. 33 years ago is a long time. I need an apology, and I need an admission, and I need to know what was ever done, if anything. Because I have carried this, and it has destroyed my life.
This is More to Say. I'm Doug Fabrizio. KUER's Lee Hale joined us on Radio West this week to talk about the recording and everything that's come of it. Let's start with, I want to start with the recording. This was leaked by the website, as I mentioned, Mormon Leaks. Just say something about what Mormon Leaks is, first of all.
It's the WikiLeaks for Mormons, basically, in that style. The idea is that they are finding documents or recordings that most church members or people interested in the church would never have access to. A lot of what their leaks have been in the past are recordings from Temple Square where general authorities are talking with each other about current events, which are kind of obscure meetings you wouldn't know even happened, let alone watch them in full. And so this is what they do. They drop these recordings. This one was a little unique. I don't think I've seen one quite like this from Mormon Leaks yet.
We should mention that this was released without the consent of the woman on the recording.
Right. And initially they apologized for that. And then she later said through them that she appreciates it coming to the public.
Now, the reason, I'm not sure why she didn't offer it to them at first. I mean, and this is something we can maybe come back to, but there are apparently some settlement negotiations going on between her attorney and, yeah. and the church itself. And
right.
That may have something to do with it, we think.
Right. That is that she was in settlement talks with the church, and this complicated that, yeah. Right? It becoming public, because obviously part of settlement talks was that it wouldn't become public.
Yeah.
So I think that in her statement through Mormon Leaks, she said basically, I was initially upset, but this is accomplishing a greater purpose.
Do we have any sense of whether or not the church was trying to, through the negotiations with this woman, keep it from coming out?
Who wouldn't, right? As an organization, yeah. Right? I think it's the right to assume is that this wouldn't have become public. This would have been a quiet issue.
Okay, so let's talk about, I mentioned what happens on the tape. Now she, how is it that she's getting this interview with Joseph Bishop? She's saying that she's doing... She's a reporter, basically.
Yeah, it seems like he might even be a little confused at the original premise, but it seems like she's just really interested in his life as a church leader, right, as a Mormon church leader, and that it's kind of autobiographical or biographical, the nature of the questions.
So what I'd like to do is get an idea of some of the, like, the state presidents. Obviously, there are a million of those. Temple presidents, and I've got a few of those. But you served two mission presidencies, so...
Three.
He's happy, yeah. As any 80-year-old, 85-year-old man would be, to talk about his life in great detail.
Yeah.
And she entertains that idea for about 40 minutes on tape, that they're kind of going through this pleasant conversation about his life, about his callings, and then it takes a turn.
I was at the MPC in 84, and you were my mission president.
No wonder you're so talented.
Is that why?
Explain the turn. What happens?
She lets him know that while she was a missionary, he was the missionary training center president, and that he assaulted her.
I'm not angry with you, because I think
you ought to be.
Well, maybe, but I'm not. I'm over a lot of things that have happened to me, but you hurt me, and I need an apology.
Well, I apologize from the depth of my heart. I can't remember what it was, but I'm...
You know what's remarkable about it is, in some ways, is that he stays. in the conversation that he engages with her. Let me make this clear. That does not excuse anything that happened. But he doesn't admit to, or at least remember, her most serious allegation. We'll talk about that in a moment. But he does stay for nearly 3 hours, which is remarkable and interesting. He confesses to her about a lot of things. That part is fascinating.
Yeah, he's very vulnerable in a sense. I don't think he would have been as open if he knew it was being recorded. But
he did not know that. Well, let's make that clear,
right.
Of course.
In talking to his son, Greg Bishop, last week, you know, he talked about how Joseph has recently had a heart attack. He went through surgery. I think that his son said basically he's kind of in a vulnerable place in his life right now, nearing possibly the end of his life. And maybe that was the right combination for him to really just talk about these things, really just kind of unload and admit to feeling, you know, what he calls an addiction, and admitting to molesting more than one woman. And listening to that is kind of shocking. You're not used to somebody talking that freely about misdeeds and some things that are really dark parts of his past.
I remember one when I was in the bishopric.
That was so long before you were a mission president.
That was.
Oh, my God.
And I remember you.
You're assessing the reaction from different people. I'm guessing there are people who are inclined to, I don't know if feel sorry for Joseph Bishop is quite the right word, but seeing, it seems like his son is this way, feeling like this is an elderly gentleman, not completely composed of all his faculties, perhaps having been taken aback, and is revealing things, not knowing he's being recorded, may even be confused. Again, which is not to excuse anything, but let's just explain that. Is there some sense that might be going on there?
I think that some people I think some people sided with him, but that happens with a lot of assault allegations, right?
Yeah.
Part of what I think upset a lot of people I noticed online was that when the church did make a statement, which they did the day after, on Tuesday last week, they mentioned things about the woman that people felt like were irrelevant, the fact that she was no longer a church member.
Let me read that. I think this is interesting. It says, these allegations are very serious and deeply disturbing. If the allegations of sexual assault are true, it would be a tragic betrayal.
Yeah, so big caveat.
Caveat there. That's interesting. But also, the way they describe her is interesting in this statement. Here it is. The matter was brought to the attention of the church in 2010 when this former church member who served briefly as a missionary. Now, would you just translate what that says? Because I think some people may not see the import of that, but
she came home early.
Seems packed.
Right.
Yeah.
She came home early. There's a stigma there that she couldn't serve a full honorable mission.
Which might imply what?
Well, it's kind of a cultural death sentence for people, because it seems like they're either not worthy enough or not strong enough to do something that most people are able to accomplish, or at least if they set out to do, they're going to finish. That's another, I think, point that people would say is irrelevant to the fact, you know, whether she was assaulted or not. It doesn't matter. In the recording, she even says part of the reason she came home had to do with the assault, that she was so shocked by that and affected by that she couldn't serve a full mission.
But the statement doesn't say anything about that.
No. And I think probably what church PR was feeling was a lot of what Mormons were feeling was disbelief. Mormons don't want to believe that this could happen at the Missionary Training Center, especially. I mean, the amount of power a president of the Missionary Training Center has over these vulnerable missionaries who've just left their families, who are just committing to this huge portion of service.
Thousands of young people.
Right. And a mission president, an MTC president, they're kind of this paternal, you know, it's like they're a mix of a parent, of a general authority, of like all these church leaders in one. So I think people just really wanted to believe that somebody who is vetted for that job would never do something like that. And I think that some of that disbelief even comes through in that statement.
Now, to the most serious allegation that she makes, that he led her into a basement room.
Do you remember the room in the basement?
I do.
Do you remember the movies in the basement? The DVD or the VHS player on the TV?
No.
Do you remember tearing my blouse, pulling up my skirt, ripping the back of my skirt and trying to rape me? But you didn't, because you didn't have a full erection. You don't remember that?
No.
Now, what is it explain, Lee, if you would, what it is that Bishop admits to or doesn't admit to, because he says in the tape he doesn't remember that particular moment.
So he's never said, you know, agreed. He's never agreed to the rape allegation. He apologizes to her over and over again, and he says, I must have done something very terrible to you. He doesn't really clarify what that could have been.
Yeah.
A big revelation last week that has kind of been the substance of most people's reporting is a BYU police report made about the same time as this recording, where the BYU police went and interviewed her and Joseph Bishop. And in that, he admits to taking her to this room, a weird room in the basement. You know, it's kind of a strange...
She says there's a bed and some tapes and stuff like that. He said there wasn't a bed.
Right.
Otherwise, it's a basement room.
It's a basement room where a young missionary should not be, I'm sure.
Alone with an older man.
But especially the MTC, there's various... missionaries are kind of corralled at these places, so very strange place to be. And he says that in there, he asked her to expose her breast to him.
So he does admit to that.
He does admit to that. So that is the solid... confession. That is kind of the substance of the reporting so far.
What happened in the report? She reported this mm-hmm. to the BYU police.
Right.
What did they do with it?
Well, it's in the '80s.
Yeah.
So up to that, to them, it was past the statute of limitations. There was no action to be taken. I think Mormons see that and think, well, you know, there still is church disciplinary action that can be taken. Right. He's still a member in seemingly high standing in the church. But as far as the police are concerned, it's out of their hands.
There's an official report by David Sturgill, Deputy Utah County Attorney.
Right.
When was this?
The report, when it came out?
Yeah.
I think it came out on Wednesday night, or at least news outlets became more of it on Wednesday night.
I want to read part of this because, again, this goes to the question of the statute of limitations. David Sturgill writes in this report, after thorough review and careful consideration, I've determined I cannot pursue criminal charges against Mr. Bishop. I have no reason to doubt the victim's disclosure and would have likely prosecuted Mr. Bishop, but for the expiration of the statute of limitations, the alleged rape occurred in 1984. So legally, that's where that is.
And I will say she has been sharing this story for a long time, she says, since it happened, basically. She says she shared it with a general authority, Carlos Acey, who has since passed away. At the very least, the church in their statement admits to knowing about it in 2010, years ago.
But she said she talked to a general authority much before 2010.
Right. Yeah.
This seems a crucial part of the story.
That is a crucial part, and that's the big question. The church has said that they don't have a record of that meeting. I don't know how thorough their records are on those kinds of meetings, but if that were true, if a general authority knew about a young missionary being assaulted...
By the MTC president.
Yeah, not just by anybody, but by an MTC president. I think it'd be shocking to know that nothing was done.
Now, there's some sense also that AC had given advice and counsel not to seek counseling.
And he had heard Elder Packer give a speech to bishops, I think. Or maybe it was a conference address, but he said, Elder Acey's interpretation of this was, don't go to counselors, professional counselors, when you have a bishop. Go to a bishop.
This gets to, I think, a broader point that I want to get to in the show, and we'll get to this later, that church leaders see this as opposed to being this legal matter. They perceive it as this kind of spiritual thing that can be healed or dealt with through prayer and proper leadership counsel.
Right. And it's interesting because I think what she's always wanted is for something to be done about him.
Yeah.
So I think that some people might agree that when you have some sexual assault in your past, that surely there's some spiritual healing that can take place, but that doesn't change the fact that there wasn't justice, or doesn't change the fact that somebody also might be assaulted by this man. So I think from her perspective that it felt dismissive in the sense where it's like, wait, but there's a guy out there who did this, right?
Yeah.
I will say that the church released some new guidelines about abuse, and one of those guidelines says that church leaders are not to discourage abuse survivors from going to get extra help, right? Whether that's legal help or help from police, that it's basically up to them to not discourage, which I think is, in a lot of accounts, happens.
should be taken seriously. It says most abuse allegations are true and should be taken seriously.
Right.
Now, those that are looking at that the guideline say that's a good thing. There are some critics of it that say it doesn't go quite far enough. And for example, it does not mandate another person in the room during these one-on-one interviews. It says leaders are, and let me quote it here, the leaders are encouraged to invite a parent or other adult to sit in an adjoining room when meeting with women or children.
It's just kind of a laundry list of some of the stories that we've been covering,
yep,
both you and I, the last few months. What's a bishop's responsibility when somebody comes to them? What's a bishop's responsibility when they're counseling a child about potentially sexually explicit things? So the church is kind of going, you know, one by one and readjusting some guidelines, or at least clarifying some guidelines. I think that this shows that the church is being responsive, maybe more responsive than some people expected.
Yeah.
And I think that that should be pointed out, that it's a good thing that the church is responding. I think the criticism is founded in the sense that maybe it doesn't go far enough. Also, I think people are craving more of a conversation about it. It's one thing to just drop a document, and it's another thing to really have an open conversation about how is abuse happening? Is it still happening? Are there church members right now who have had very similar experiences who need to be encouraged to come out too?
Well, there was no press conference.
Right.
No opportunity really to get much beyond the statement, frankly. And I should say we asked the church to possibly offer a representative to join us, and they declined.
And that's business as usual.
Of course.
This is something, though, that this isn't as controversial as other topics the church might not want to speak out about. This is abuse, and especially of a young missionary. It seems like something that most Mormons hopefully can get behind, right? That abuse should not be happening, especially at the hands of an LDS church leader.
Is there a credible case to be made that there were attempts to cover this up?
So I think it's fair to say that the church is not interested in recordings like this coming to light. I mean, whether that's a cover-up or whether that's just trying, or that's a denial, I don't know what that is, but that seems like this is not ideal for them.
The statement, the initial statement, and then the release yesterday of the new guidelines, what does this tell us, if anything, about the new administration of President Russell Nelson as the new president of the Mormon Church?
As a reporter, PR has been more responsive since he's been in this new calling, mm-hmm. And I appreciate that, honestly. I think that you can disagree with the church, but at least you want to hear from the church, at the very least. And so I think the fact that they are releasing, they've released three statements in a matter of basically a week since this happened, that to me is a lot more open communication than previous. So I think that my assumption is that President Nelson is kind of allowing people to, at least the PR department, to act and to say some things. It'll be interesting this weekend as General Conference,
right.
His first General Conference as president.
Yes.
Is this going to be a subtle hint at abuse? Is somebody going to go head on and acknowledge that this is happening?
Or if you were to guess, what would you say?
I would imagine one or two lines about abuse cannot be tolerated. You know, abuse victims are meant to be, believed and understood, but that might be a passing comment in one talk. That's my expectation. There's this brick wall for people when it comes to assault in the church to share their stories, because this isn't just a company you worked for once.
Yeah.
This is your church. This is potentially your path to salvation. You look at the new guidelines and there's a hotline, an abuse hotline. And you might think that an abuse hotline would be for the people that are abused, but it's for the bishop.
Yeah.
So there's still this bishop barricade, right? There isn't this easy path for somebody who's potentially been abused by somebody, whether it's in their family or, you know, a church leader. There's just no clear path to say this happened to me and I need help. And I think until that changes, I don't think that we'll hear enough stories.
It's Lee Hale, KUER's religion reporter. Lee, thanks.
Thanks.
I thought this would be enough. I don't know. I don't know now. I don't know that I can just go back to my little life. I can't get my innocence from the MTC back. I can't serve a mission and love the Lord and respect my priesthood leaders ever. Probably not in this lifetime.
More to Say is a production of KUER News. The team includes Lee Hale, Doug Fabrizio, and Tim Slover. This conversation continues on Radio West with LDS blogger Angela Clayton, marriage and family therapist Natasha Helfer Parker, and acting director of Sunstone magazine Lindsay Hansen Park. Listen at radiowest.org.